Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, the U.S. is involved in several current wars around the world and on the brink of war in other areas, including the Korean Peninsula. We're going to talk about the range of dangerous situations around the world facing the U.S. and to what extent are policies coming out of Washington helping or hurting to make the world a safer place. Today, we're going to talk with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who worked in the Bush administration under Secretary of State Colin Powell. He'll be speaking in Sarasota in a few days. And later, we'll talk with members of the group Florida Veterans for Common Sense, which is bringing Colonel Wilkerson here to the area. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we discussed a bill in Tallahassee that would require the words, "In God We Trust," be prominently displayed in every public school in the state. Here's what one listener had to say.
This is Elizabeth in Riverview on your Wednesday's program. In God We Trust. How hypocritical. In God We Trust, all others cash. Okay, if they'd write that up on the school wall, I'd go along with it. Other than that, just, you know, let it float out there in cyberspace or whatever.
There was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. Well, Florida Veterans for Common Sense is holding its annual dinner and birthday celebration honoring patriot and founding father Thomas Paine on Saturday evening, February 3rd at the Francis on Palm Avenue in downtown Sarasota. The event will feature a speech by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a former aide to Colin Powell. Wilkerson is a retired colonel. He's the former chief of staff to Colin Powell. He'll be speaking at the annual Thomas Paine dinner, February 3rd. And I spoke with him yesterday about what's going on in the world, especially about what's going on in the Trump foreign policy. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, welcome to WMNF.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you about the vice president's recent trip to the Middle East. He said there that the Trump administration wants to pull out of the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal unless the pact is amended. What's your take on that?
Well, from the first point of view, there is no real possibility for the JCPOA to be amended. Our partners in it, including Iran, simply won't let it happen. Europe, in particular, I think, is going to go its own way. And I know Russia and China will, almost with 99% certainty. So it was really kind of a ridiculous statement, unless, of course, your ultimate objective, which I think this is the case, is to abrogate the deal and to not give a damn, frankly, about your allies and others in the deal. His speech to the Knesset, such as it was summed up best, I think, by a friend of mine who is a Christian in Jerusalem and who remarked to me that, as he had done in 2002 when Powell was visiting as Secretary of State Arafat in Ramallah, that the most formidable foe Christians face in Jerusalem and in the area in general is Israel, not the Muslims, not Arabs, not Palestinians, but Israel. They're most oppressed, if you will, by the fact that Israel continues to spread its territory in both the city and the West Bank and elsewhere. And that really frightens them. And I think Pence identifying so readily with Israel, apparently because he feels that in accordance with the biblical prophecy, Israel has to be, or the land around Israel, and Jerusalem in particular, has to be controlled by Israel before the rapture can occur, was really tantamount to taking the Bible and hurling it into foreign and security policy in a way that I think is quite dangerous.
I understand that, but I'm curious, why would a Christian feel threatened by this? Because I know that there's a lot of evangelicals here in the U.S. that are cheering on the Trump administration when it comes to, for instance, moving the embassy to Jerusalem.
True, but not all of them. I find the 48 to 68 million now evangelical community in the United States to be quite divided itself. You have sects like the Dominionists, with whom I identify, people like Mike Pence, who, for example, want to take over the armed forces of the United States and get them to act for God and Jesus rather than the Constitution and the United States. These are very radical sects within the evangelical community, and I certainly don't paint that whole community with the same brush that I paint them. The reason I think, for example, in 2002, the head of the Christian Church in Jerusalem told me that he was very concerned about Israel's policies and more concerned about them than he was any Muslim or Arab or Palestinian policy, was that they were really antithetical to Christian interests in the region. The Christian interests, basically, whether you're talking about the head of the Greek Orthodox Church or you're talking about others in the region who profess to be Christians, is to live with everyone and to have stability and peace and ultimately some sort of prosperity, whether it's Jerusalem or Israel or what might become a Palestinian state or whatever. That's their policy. They don't see that as the hard right-line policy of Bibi Netanyahu, Avigdor Lieberman, and other ultra-Orthodox people who are pursuing, really, a Zionist policy from Tel Aviv. And they're very worried about that because they feel like they'll be the first ones to go.
We're talking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who will be speaking February 3rd in Sarasota. We'll tell you about that in just a moment. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Colonel, getting back to Iran, though, it looks like the U.S. is taking sides in the dispute between Iran and Saudi Arabia in that part of the world. The so-called Sunni-Shiite split, I don't know if you would agree that there is such a split and if it's a fair characterization or it's too simplistic, but it looks like the harsh words towards Iran and the selling of arms to Saudi Arabia indicates that we're leaning towards Saudi Arabia in that dispute. How would you characterize what's going on there?
No, I'd characterize it exactly as you just did. The United States, particularly under Trump, but Obama too. Obama really sold more arms to the Saudis than almost any president since World War II. So he might have cloaked his rhetoric a bit, but his actions were as bad, if not worse, than Trump's with regard to Saudi Arabia. And I think what we're seeing right now is not a sectarian divide so much as we're seeing a power struggle into which I would thrust Israel too, but that's a different matter, between Tehran, Riyadh, and ultimately Tel Aviv, with Tel Aviv sort of sitting back and watching and seeing who the United States backs at any given time. And of late, because of Tel Aviv's essential alliance of opportunity with Saudi Arabia, which has seen such bizarre things as Saudi Arabia identifying with Israel's move or wanting the U.S. to move its capital to Jerusalem, which has made Jordan's king angry, very angry, and I don't blame him for being so. And we're perturbating our traditional allies in the region by doing this. But what we have is a power struggle between basically Riyadh and Tehran. And we have a new leader in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, a young man who, among other things, started one of the most brutal wars the region's seen in a long time, the war in Yemen. And increasingly that conflict, being lost majorly and miserably by Saudi Arabia, that conflict is being viewed by the people in the region, particularly in Yemen, as the U.S. with the Saudis acting as our proxy. And so you get things like U.S. Special Forces who are in Yemen legitimately fighting al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, one of the most powerful al-Qaeda elements in the region. You get the SOF, U.S. Special Operating Forces, saying, hey, this is crazy because every time the Saudis bomb another wedding party and kill 144 people, as they did the other day, we get 10 to 12 more recruits a minute for al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So we're losing our struggle against the most dangerous enemy in Yemen while you back Saudi Arabia killing all these innocent civilians, men, women, children, and perpetrating one of the greatest humanitarian disasters since World War II, cholera, lack of food, and so forth. It's a tragic thing, and the Saudis are losing. So our being so close to Saudi Arabia right now Israel's tacit alliance of convenience with Riyadh because of Tehran, and our opposition to Tehran, which now looks like, if you believe Secretary Tillerson's speech on 17 January out at Stanford, we're getting ready to throw U.S. forces into Syria to continue the struggle there, but this time with Iran, you understand the poison that's developing in that region to suck the United States into its midst. I mean, it's an extremely dangerous situation, and we seem to be playing checkers rather than chess like all the rest of the players in the struggle. And I don't leave Russia, and I don't leave Turkey out of that.
Hmm. In the long term, if you look at Iran and its potential to emerge, to turn into a secular small-d democracy, or if you look at Saudi Arabia and its potential to emerge as a secular democracy in the long run, which has the most potential to go in that direction? And maybe that's not the question I should be asking, but you know, if we're going to choose sides, should we choose Saudi Arabia over Iran?
I think that's a very dangerous decision, and I think Obama more or less reinforced that, and I think Trump has, with his sword dance in Riyadh, and I think, frankly, a fundamental ignorance about the region, reinforced it. And you're right. If I were picking my allies, my friends, my potentially powerful countries in the region for the future, I definitely wouldn't be picking Saudi Arabia. Hmm. Now, that said, I still have to remember that Saudi Arabia has a lot of that black gold left and still denominates its oil sales in dollars. And other than the United States military and those oil sales denominated in dollars, there is not very much standing of any hard nature behind the United States dollar today. And so if we were to suddenly break with Saudi Arabia, as one senator said to me the other day when we were talking about the illegal U.S. support for Saudi Arabia in Yemen, and it is illegal, it's unconstitutional, it's not covered by the authorization for the use of military force. When I was talking to this senator, he said to me, yeah, I know, Larry, I know what you're talking about. I understand the war is illegal, and it ties us with in accordance with Title 50, the War Powers Act, codified into U.S. law. And I also understand that Saudi Arabia is a treacherous ally, but we can't afford to back away too rapidly from Saudi Arabia because of the dollar. And I understand that argument. I understand that argument. But all I'm saying is, in the long term, your question is a good question, and the answer is, yes, there are better partners in the region than Saudi Arabia.
If Saudi Arabia was to go off the dollar, where would it go? To whose currency would it turn?
Well, the UAE, in a threat to us, I mean, I can't see it any other way, has already begun to denominate its oil sales in euros, and occasionally when they're in Asia, in renminbi, the Chinese currency. And the Chinese have been sneaking up on our currency ever since Deng Xiaoping declared that one day China would be overwhelmingly more economically and financially powerful than the United States. Yeah, they're getting to a position now. They're already the number one economy in the world in terms of purchasing power parity. And in another 10 to 15 years, they're probably going to dwarf us in terms of GDP as well. So this is something that people aren't paying enough attention to at Treasury, in the White House, or wherever. The Chinese threat to, I think it's 32% of our notes they own right now, our Treasury notes, the Chinese threat to start selling those is, that's just the tip of the dagger. I mean, they have quite a potential to damage us if they want to. Now, they don't do it fast, and they don't do it profoundly yet, because it would, of course, damage their economy, too, because they're still selling majorly. But it's coming. It's coming, and it's apt to be sort of like on Monday we go to sleep and everything's fine, and on Tuesday morning we wind up and inflation's off the chart because we've lost the power of the dollar as the world's reserve and transactional currency.
Our guest is Lawrence Wilkerson, former aide to Secretary of State Colin Powell. He'll be speaking in Sarasota on February 3rd. We'll tell you more about that in just a moment. Getting back to the question of moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a good idea. Does that advance the cause of peace in that region?
I don't think so. I'll wait and see. I'll reserve my opinion, and see what else they do. But basically what I see happening with Netanyahu's government, both from design and from political necessity because of the really somewhat fragile coalition he holds together in the Knesset, is very dangerous. It's Zionism writ large. I think his profession recently that Golan is his, that the West Bank is his continuing with the settlements as if no one objects, his move with regard to reinforcing the U.S. decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem, all these things are part of his plan. I think he is not in the least interested in a two-state solution. I think he has declared it dead privately. He's almost done it publicly. And I think he's going to go from that position. I'm not even sure that he doesn't covet, ultimately, portions of Jordan. And I think the royal family in Amman realizes that. And so we're looking at probably one of the most precarious situations with regard to Israel's ultimate long-term security since 1948. And that's the overreach of Bibi Netanyahu and his cohort.
The other day, on a different topic, Army announced that it was looking at preparing to send 1,000 more troops to Afghanistan, adding to the, I think, 14,000 U.S. troops that are already there. What do you make of that?
I think there's been a strategic decision in the Pentagon, if not in the White House, and it probably was in the Pentagon because I think Trump has pretty much turned Afghanistan over to the, quote, generals, unquote. I think there's been a strategic decision that the Taliban are second, third, even fourth priority in Afghanistan. What our presence in Afghanistan is about now is very strategic, and we will be there for another 50 years because of that. The first strategic purpose for our presence there is to maintain hard power in the only position that it exists now in substantial form to impact, if necessary, the so-called Chinese trillion-dollar effort to build a Silk Road between Xinjiang province in China and ultimately Europe. This includes pipelines, both gas and oil. It includes things like the economic corridor they've now built across Kashmir and into Pakistan, so that they're exacerbating the Pakistan-India situation. It involves enormous amounts of economic effort that we can't possibly match because we simply don't have the money. So we're sitting there in Afghanistan now, first and foremost, in case we have to use hard power against the Chinese in some way. That's a good position from which to do so from that flank. The second reason we're in Afghanistan is that we want to have hard power close by the most dangerous and arguably unstable large stockpile of nuclear weapons in the world. It's in Pakistan. And we want to be able to move swiftly and dramatically in order to control those weapons if we have to, if things really go bad in Pakistan. So I think the Taliban terrorists, they're a third priority, fourth priority in Afghanistan. And I think we're going to be there as we were in Germany, as we were in Japan, still are, as we were and are in Korea post-World War II, for another half century or so, because this is the new great strategic game, China, the U.S., Russia, and Central Asia.
China's using its money, to build public works projects in Africa and developing nations. We don't tend to do that. Is that a mistake on our part? Is China making more friends around the world? Or what is China doing by building these public works projects in Africa and the Caribbean and everywhere else?
First and foremost, and when Richard Haas and I were talking with Wang Yi and Shui Ten Kai, now the Chinese foreign minister and ambassador of the United States, respectively, in July in 2001, when we held policy planning talks in Beijing, we actually got an inkling of this. It's a positive development if the Chinese are not aggressive and not seeking hegemony in doing what they're doing. If what they're doing is to make money for themselves while elevating other countries in the world, making them more prosperous so they'll be better clients for buying Chinese products and so forth. It's not unlike what we did with the Marshall Plan after World War II. But I fear that when a country grows as powerful as China and as rich as China, and this is, you may have heard of Graham Allison's the Thucydides trap, which, you know, very simply stated, means a rising great power and a status quo great power are inevitably going to fight. I hope that's not true. I hope Graham's wrong in that thesis. But it is a historical phenomenon one can point at. It's very difficult to imagine how, if China becomes more and more aggressive in its pursuit of these other regions and these other countries, then the United States is going to feel threatened, and we're going to wind up, as Graham posits, we're going to wind up having a war between China and the United States. And there are so many hot spots like Taiwan and the South China Sea and Afghanistan and Pakistan that I could paint a fairly logical path to that war. I hope I'm wrong. Mm. But that's part of the problem with the Chinese rising as fast as they are and being as rich as they are. I mean, they've got trillions of dollars to spend, and when you ask the question why we don't do it, we've got trillions of dollars in debt.
Mm. Well, one of those hot spots is North Korea. The President Trump, is taking credit for what appears to be a thaw in relations between North and South Korea in regard to the Winter Olympics. Does the president get the credit for the thaw, or was that something internally going on over on the Korean Peninsula?
I think he'll take credit for whatever happens in the world that looks like it might somehow serendipitously have flowed from his rhetoric. I don't think he deserves any of the credit at all. I think the credit there goes to the new regime in South Korea, who probably would have moved even more rapidly to do what they're doing with regard to the Olympics had we not thrust into their midst, just as their administration was changing, the theater high altitude air defense problem, which has caused them great angst with China and shown them how powerful China is. When China got angry at that and pretty much cut off about a third of the Korean economy because China is Korea's biggest buyer and biggest trade partner. So we essentially relaxed a little bit after that because we realized we were driving South Korea away. And this administration's policy, not unlike the previous administration from this group of politicians, has been to seek some sort of rapprochement with North Korea. And this is that effort starting once again with this new administration. So I think it's fairly preposterous for Trump to take claim for this, because it would have been South Korea's policy all along. It might have even started even earlier if there hadn't been all the rhetoric, and particularly if there hadn't been that deployment of the THAAD to South Korea.
Hmm. One last question, and that is the State Department staff has been downsized under President Trump. At least he's not hiring to replace the people who've left. And then at the same time, both the Democrats and Republicans have wanted to increase military spending. As a guy that once worked in the State Department for the Secretary of State, what do you think of that?
There are a number of things that Tillerson has done, however imperfectly and inexpertly, that I would have probably done too if I'd had carte blanche. The State Department was way too heavy in people that had really nothing much to do except draw paycheck. So that's the first comment. The second comment is, going into the raw bone and muscle of the State Department now, though, is, I think, a mistake of the first order. And that's what they're doing. And they're not doing it just by the moves Tillerson is making, but by the lowering of morale amongst the Foreign Service in particular that these kinds of what they view as inept moves create. So you might wind up waking up one morning and having a third or more of your Foreign Service gone. That's not good. Secretary Gates and Secretary Clinton, to their credit, when they took over respectively defense and state, began the first effort in a long, long time to sort of tamp down the military effort and money and transfer, or at least ensure an increase in diplomatic effort and money going to that effort. That's been stopped completely, reversed, and put in an accelerated downturn. Now, I think that's very sad, because I think what this administration is doing, and it's going to be extremely complex and difficult for the new president, whether it's in 3 years or 7 years, to reverse this process. What Trump is doing is dismantling diplomacy as an instrument of national policy. Now, what he would say he's doing is he's transferring it from Foggy Bottom in the State Department to the White House. Well, I've got news for President Trump. That's been happening ever since Richard Nixon in 1972, because Republicans have always, and Democrats too to a certain extent, tried to consolidate foreign and security policy in the White House with the National Security Council staff and keep it away from the State Department. But Trump has put a new spin on that and taken it to a new depth. So when you look at people like he has assembled around him, and indeed look at the president himself, and you say, they're going to conduct diplomacy for the United States of America in lieu of the State Department, that scares the bejesus out of me. And in order to reconstruct what they've destroyed in 7 years or 3 years, it's going to take a whale of an effort and a lot of money. And it's just pitiful that we're doing that.
Do we need to build up our military? And when the president said the other day during the shutdown that the Democrats were keeping paychecks away from military personnel and their family, was he right? Or is this the increased money for the military going to things beyond just members of the service?
This is going to be heresy coming from a 31-year veteran in the United States Army. But I think one of the healthiest things that could happen to the Pentagon tomorrow morning would be if it got cut several billion dollars. And over the next 10 years, it got cut $100 billion per year and a total of $1 trillion. And I can show you a plan to do that. I can show you the systems I would change, the strategies I would change, and so forth. Because as we've seen so many times before, when you get too much money, you become fat, dumb, and happy. And all you can think of is screaming for more money. And that's what we've got now. And I have a lot of respect for Jim Mattis, and I have respect for Chuck Hagel and other secretaries of defense, but they've all come in there and ultimately become exponents of the status quo. Things like F-35 aircraft, which we need like a hole in the head, and cost so much that a single aircraft bodes to bankrupt us. And the Air Force putting the new bomber online, the Navy putting the new ballistic missile submarine online, we're looking at costs that are just astronomical. When Eisenhower made his speech to the Society of Newspaper Editors in 1953, and said, this is no way of life at all under the threatening cloud of war. This is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. That cross of iron was the military-industrial complex. And I don't think even Eisenhower envisioned how powerful that complex would ultimately become. And we're slaves to it now. The war in Yemen, for example. Look at Raytheon's share price. Look at the other defense contractors who are contributing to that war. And you know immediately why the United States, or at least one big reason, why the United States continues to support the Saudis, the UAE, and others in that coalition in that bloody, losing conflict. That's because defense contractors are making so much money out of it.
So there is waste in military spending.
Huge waste. in huge ways.
And when the president says that we're denying money to the soldiers, you're suggesting that we're maybe denying money to the defense contractors.
That's part of it. Part of it also, though, and this is something the American people need to become aware of. The all-volunteer force, decided on by Richard Nixon in 1973 for largely political reasons, is falling apart. It's too expensive. When you have an Air Force that is 2,000 pilots short and is willing to pay $455,000 bonuses to pilots who will sign up for a 12-year hitch, and when you have people like my son, who is a Reaper drone operator, telling me about working 12-hour shifts instead of 8, and shortages and so forth. And when you have an army, the American people need to awaken to this fact. There are more soldiers recruited in the state of Alabama with a population of about 5 million than are recruited from New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago with an aggregate population of over 30 million combined. Most of the army now comes from 13 states. And those are generally the states that are most poverty-stricken, that have the highest rates of obesity, the lowest rates of affluence and intellectual competence. We're costing ourselves out of the military by personnel costs. I just read an article in Proceedings magazine by a sailor, good article, and it says the Navy needs ships like the Zumwalt, the newest guided missile ship, that are automated because it can't man its ships. I almost fell off my chair when Trump said he wanted a 350-ship Navy because I wanted to shout at the president, where are you going to find the people? Because you can't pay for them. The all-volunteer force is so expensive today that better than 50% of a $600 billion defense budget is being spent on people.
Well, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. I could spend another 5 hours hearing what you have to say on all these topics and more, and there's a bunch we didn't cover, but thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Larry, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, retired. He's a former chief of staff to Colin Powell during the Bush administration. He's coming to Sarasota. He'll be speaking at the annual Thomas Paine Dinner, sponsored by Florida Veterans for Common Sense. That's February 3rd at the Francis in downtown Sarasota at 6 p.m. We'll tell you how you can find out about tickets in just a moment. Three members of that group that is sponsoring Wilkerson's speech are going to join us in a moment. If you want to comment about the speech, or rather the interview you just heard, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. Well, we're joined now by three members of Florida Veterans for Common Sense. Dennis Plews is here, James Derman, and Camille Van Zandt. And welcome to WMNF, all of you. Great to see you.
Good morning.
Hi. How
good
you morning.
Doing, Rob?
Thanks for driving up from Sarasota. First, Dennis, tell us what's the purpose of your group, Florida Veterans for Common Sense?
Well, good morning, Rob, and thanks again for having us on. Florida Veterans for Common Sense and Larry Wilkerson actually run together quite strongly, in as much as we became an organization as a result of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's efforts to invade Iraq. A bunch of lawyers in Sarasota who are also combat veterans had heard the arguments before about another war and realized that the arguments made in behalf of invading Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein were bogus, and we formed in an effort to educate the local community about why invading Iraq was the wrong thing to do at that time.
You were served in the Marines in Vietnam in
1960? No, I was Army, Jim was the Marine.
I'm sorry, Jim, you were in the Marines, right? Yes. And what were your years of service?
I was active duty 1964 to 67.
Were you in Vietnam?
Yes, yeah. 66, 67.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just as Jim was leaving Vietnam, and actually in the same area, I was coming in.
And Camille Van Zandt, you also served in the military. What branch?
Yes, I was in the Navy in 79 to 83. I had, of course, it was during peacetime. I was electronic technician in NAS North Island in San Diego.
What is it about Wilkerson? Why would your group, and what about his ideas align with the ideas of Florida Veterans for Common Sense? I mean, you talked about your opposition to the invasion of Iraq in 2002, 2003, Dennis. Camille, do you want to comment about Wilkerson a little bit, about what anything he said there?
Well, he seems very insightful. I liked his comments as far as being very honest. It's difficult sometimes for military. Usually as they retire, they can be more honest.
When they're wearing the uniform,
opinions.
It's difficult to be honest. Yeah.
I mostly focused on helping the veterans as they come back. That's my mission.
Well, you are with something called the Green Path Farms. Tell us what you do.
Well, Green Path's mission is to empower veterans so that they can be successful as they transition back to civilian life, but to also help the Vietnam vets. Were really neglected as they come back, and they are still suffering. And they can have positive effects by coming to the farm. The work itself is therapy for them, without labeling it as such, because they're strong people and they don't want to appear weak, that they need help. But having experienced traumatic events like that can affect you deeply, and coming home where we are, you know, very comfortable in our lives, it's hard for their families to understand what they're going through. And so they need to be together. I thought at first the farm was very effective in that they're in nature and it's calming and they see the beauty of nature. But I'm finding out that more importantly for them to be together working as a team again, that helps them get through. And they can talk about things if they want to, or they can bust chops like they always love to do. And
I noticed Dennis is very good at that.
Yes, he is.
Well, you know, if you're an artilleryman, that's your job.
But that's so common. I had missed that. And as soon as I came and met the Florida Vets for Common Sense, I saw it all over again. I said, yes, I'm home again, because that's what we do.
What do you think the civilian population needs to know about veterans that maybe the civilian population doesn't understand? Because as Larry Wilkerson was saying, we've got an all-volunteer army. And a lot of people, when we had the draft, a lot of people were serving. But now, that's not true. What do you think?
Do have a volunteer service, but they're still dealing with traumatic experience. And we just can't relate. We have to give them a lot of time to adjust, and we have to accept their missteps and keep helping and not give up on them, because they deserve it. I mean, they're the reason we're free.
How can people find out more about Green Path Farms?
Well, we do have a Facebook page, Green Path Veterans Farms, and I try to keep it up. We've just got some great grants from Manatee Match, Manatee Community Foundation, and also from State College of Florida during the MLK Day of Service. And we've done some great improvements. We are actually on guests at Easter Seals of Southwest Florida in Sarasota, and we share space with them and land. They have a Academy Farms that is run for the disabled students there, and they started a certified organic farm, and they invited us to join them. And so it's a great relationship and partnership. The vets love to work with the kids and vice versa. But also, we need to find our own land, because we need to expand. That's more of a demonstration farm, turning into a healing farm. But we really would like to empower vets in business of farming or related occupations. So we're looking for a bigger land, maybe 1 to 3 acres, that can also be a domicile so that we can house the vets while they're farming and learning and doing apprenticeship programs, sort of like an incubator farm, help them do their own entrepreneurial projects.
So if somebody has some land in Sarasota or Manatee or maybe DeSoto or Hardy, somewhere in that region, the three acres or so, maybe they could turn it over to you.
That's what we've been trying to find and get the word out.
All right, so look for Green Path Farms on Facebook. And also here, that was Camille Van Sant. James Derman is here. He served in Vietnam. As you heard, he was in the Marines. James, why did you join Florida Veterans for Common Sense?
Well, I wasn't a founding member. It was an organization that had people in it that I knew in Sarasota, mostly lawyers. I'm a lawyer. And
we won't hold that against you.
Gravitating to that group, I was getting older and just needed to talk about my experiences in Vietnam. I had kind of withheld those for a long time. And so when I got into the group, I saw that there were a lot of veterans who weren't lawyers and who had nothing to do with our group that needed help, mainly because I do criminal law, seeing them in the jail. And more veterans were popping up in the jail. So in about 2010, we worked with one of our circuit judges, Judge Lee Hayworth, who was also a vet, a lieutenant colonel in the Army, served the Iraq War. He formed a group called CAVS, Courts Assisting Veterans. And so we were kind of the auxiliary to that program. It had a very small staff, two people, who would go into the jail and screen veterans and see what their problems were, what they were charged with, why they were still in the jail. And then sometimes we would come in and befriend that person, or in some cases, the lawyers would represent them. And the main thrust was, why is this man who, mainly man, who was a service member and productive, now sitting in the jail? And it would invariably go back to the traumatic experiences, PTSD, drug use, followed by crime, defrauding people, stealing money, you know, the property crimes to support the drugs generally. So that was very important to me and all the members of the group. And the program, the CAVS program, morphed into a newer program that's just starting now, which is a veterans treatment court, which is actually sponsored now by the VA. They've stepped in and have some of their personnel who are running it. So it's still a local program, but no longer the CAVS program.
You served in Vietnam. Were you in combat?
Yes, I was.
Yeah. And when you came home after in the 60s, did you experience anything? Or when did the,
yes,
these feelings that you were dealing with emerge?
I had those feelings even in Vietnam. Problems sleeping, problems of fixating on certain experiences that I was had and was continuing to have. Besides being with the 11th Marine Regiment, which is an artillery regiment similar to Dennis's, I was also with the Korean Marines as an advisor with them for about 4.5 months. So I was in the field with the Koreans, and we had a lot of combat experiences. So,
so
yes.
Would you say you had PTSD?
Yes, I do.
And so you still have it. So what has worked for you? What's helped you?
Well, I have a wonderful wife who's probably the number one feature. And then I'm going through some counseling for it, and being with this group and helping veterans has helped me a lot, to where I can relate very much to these younger fellows who have PTSD and other problems, marital problems.
When the soldiers came home from Vietnam, we didn't understand PTSD, and we didn't understand Agent Orange. There was a bunch of stuff we didn't understand about Vietnam. And when they came back, you landed, you went back home.
That's true. I think that's very true. So there's been a huge shift in the understanding of that particular syndrome and of people's recognition that it's real, that it's a part of an experience that not too many people have. As you pointed out, in Vietnam we had the draft, so we had a huge army in Vietnam. Now we don't have the draft, and so we have we still have a large army, but it's all volunteer. PTSD is still occurring every day when our people go into these other countries and have combat experiences or life-threatening experiences that they had never really had anything to prepare them for that until you have the experience.
So it's something you live with every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the CAVS program, now run by the VA, this is really, was Sarasota the first one to come up with this idea?
And I don't think so. I think it was another venue, perhaps even here in Clearwater. I think they've had one before us in Pinellas County because they're so close to Bay Pines. I think it was kind of a proximity situation with the Bay Pines staff. but we're one of the first counties to be involved.
And it's turned into something very successful.
It really has.
If I may add, it started, as far as I'm aware, in New York with the judge up there, and it quickly spread around the country. As Jim pointed out, the Sixth Circuit, Pinellas Pasco, was one of the very early adopters of the treatment court model for dealing with veterans of combat and the sequelae of their combat experiences that give them trouble in the civilian world. And that was one of our earliest projects. Actually, it was our second large project, is Florida Veterans for Common Sense, bearing in mind that the founders are all lawyers and combat veterans. We felt well suited to take on the project of getting the state of Florida to adopt statutes to implement treatment courts throughout the state. And now I'm happy to say that after our efforts, which were broadly supported by the state, we now have statutes in place that authorize treatment courts in every court in every community throughout the state of Florida. And I think that's one of our better successes as Florida Veterans for Common Sense, was our Courts Assisting Veterans program, with which Jim is still currently personally involved, since he's one of the few lawyers in our group that's still active in the bar. And he's in there working and mentoring regularly with the Veterans Courts program in our community in Sarasota.
Rob, one of the things that we just recently learned was there is now quite a few veterans who are in hospice. And we have Tidewell Hospice in Sarasota County, throughout the county. And I was just talking to the head of their volunteer group, which we have a huge volunteer segment to deal with hospice patients. And I was told that the veterans group of hospice patients are looking to get some assistance from lawyers because they either haven't had access or they haven't done their wills or their estate planning, or there's a new development in their life. They now have a new grandbaby or something that's uncompleted, not finished. And so we're now working with Bay Area Legal Services, the legal aid in Tampa, to try to get some volunteers in our bar to fulfill that need, help these vets.
So you're looking for volunteers, just like Camille's looking for land, you're looking for volunteers.
Right. We actually already have 25 lawyers who have signed up for this program.
What's the best way to get in touch with you if they want to volunteer?
Well, they can call me at my number, which is Sarasota 941-366-7997, or Linda Herodine, who is our coordinator at Minnesota Legal Aid. And unfortunately, I don't have her number, but they could get it through my office.
And I imagine they could look up Minnesota Legal Aid yes, online and find it. Dennis Plews, let me get back to you. Tell us again, if people want to make reservations or go to for more information about the Larry Wilkerson speech, how can people call up and find out more?
Certainly, Rob. Thank you. As you know, we have this annual birthday party for Thomas Paine to honor one of the most important founding fathers of the United States, the guy who gave us our name, actually the guy who gave us the Revolutionary War. He turned the tax revolt into a revolution. So in recognition of that, we hold an annual birthday party to celebrate him, and he does show up for the party, as I'm sure you remember when you were our honoree. So Citizen Paine shows up, and this year's speaker again is Colonel Larry Wilkerson, which of course is quite apropos in as much as what he was involved with as an advisor to Colin Powell when Colin was Secretary of State is why we became an organization. So we're going to get an update from Colonel Wilkerson, and you can get your tickets by going online on our website, floridaveteransforcommonsense.org, all fully typed out, floridaveteransforcommonsense.org, and find our Thomas Paine button, and you can read about the party, and you'll find a link to our Eventbrite site where you can get your tickets. Now, they're going fast, so don't wait. It's a limited facility. We can only hold about 170 people, and we're almost sold out now. We're way past the halfway mark. So if you want to get your ticket, go to Eventbrite, go to our website, Florida Veterans for Common Sense, go to the Thomas Paine party page and find the link and buy your tickets.
All right. Well, that's Dennis Plews, who is with Florida Veterans for Common Sense. Also, here are two other members of that group. Camille Van Zant is here and James Derman. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. They've all generously driven up from Sarasota today. Tell us about, we've talked about trying to help veterans and trying to assist veterans. I'm curious, too, about, do you take positions on foreign policy these days? I mean, you came out of the opposition to the invasion of Iraq back in 2002, 2003. Now, do you take positions on foreign policy?
Rob, I think you asked the question of us, you know, what did we think about that interview with Colonel Wilkerson? And the first thought that came into my mind, I have to admit, I was not really aware of his position and his uniqueness in public debate, but the word is integrity, that really for us to be properly informed and to actually see and hear the truth, you have to have somebody who was an insider, which he obviously was at the very highest levels of government, and he has spoken out on almost all of the relevant issues that were obviously so important when he was in the Bush administration, but also today with the new administration. And so, not to make a big speech about it, but it just seems my point of view, and I think agreed with my colleagues, is the U.S. has relied too much upon the force button, if you will, and getting our point across through the use of force as opposed to other more reasonable ways of working with people and helping the people. And in his case, as a helicopter pilot, trying to stop people from shooting farmers down in the rice paddies.
Yeah, we often don't think about the consequences when we bring our men and women home after the war. We don't think about the consequences of what they experienced as they're in the war. And when they come back, sometimes they're forgotten.
Yes, and that's no one thing we've been trying not to do, is forget them. And I'd like to point out that the beneficiary of this year's party is our Florida Veterans Green Path Farm Project. Now, we've had, as you know, many projects over the year. Our last two big ones were led by and directed by our women veterans. We had the Florida Women's Conference, the statewide conference of women veterans, led by our member Nadine. And this, that was several years ago. That was a great success. We had hundreds of women, even two nurses from World War II, twins, showed up for that event. And now Camille, our sailor, is running our current big project, in which we're trying to provide opportunities for employment and income to veterans in the burgeoning local vore and edible landscaped business. And that's what Florida Veterans Green Path Farm is all about, providing opportunities for veterans in our community.
Hmm. Camille, I want to go back to returning veterans for a moment. We know the mistakes we made after veterans were coming back from Vietnam, not providing them counseling immediately, not understanding the long-term effects of Agent Orange, clearly having no understanding of PTSD. We called it other things in World War II and the Korean War. What about today?
Today, I see that, I think, unfortunately, probably from guilt of not helping the Vietnam vets, I think the community at large is really going over and above to help veterans. I see a lot in the community wanting to help them. The trouble is bringing them out. You know, a lot of them become recluse because they're having these issues. A lot of them can't be near noise, which is great for the farm because it's a quiet atmosphere. Many of them, you know, retreat into the woods and things where it's calm and there's not loud noises. And so that's why the farm is very therapeutic, just by being there, not by making an attempt to talk to them and have them, you know, say their feelings. It's just by being there, playing in the dirt, just like you when you were a little kid, and just that calm. They don't talk about the war very often, or politics or foreign policy. They are trying to forget that. And so we kind of keep it on the down low, and everybody's just trying to encourage each other. A lot of joking around. That's therapy, joking around.
Do you sell your products?
We do sell our produce. Right now we have one restaurant on board, Arts and Eats, in Bradenton, in the Village of the Arts of Bradenton. You need a creative chef. We do a lot of unusual tropical things. We do have other chefs that want to purchase our produce and help out, but we need more land. We can only produce so much on that small piece of land. Right now we're just barely producing on more than an eighth of an acre.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but that is we've been talking with three members of the group Florida Veterans for Common Sense, and that was our guest Camille Van Zandt. Also here, James Derman and Dennis Plouse. Thank you so much, Camille, James, and Dennis, for coming up to WMNF.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
Good luck on the dinner, the Thomas Paine dinner. It's February 3rd at the Francis in downtown Sarasota. You'll all be there, and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson will be the headline speaker that night at 6 p.m. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
If you want to comment about today's show, call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. Stay tuned for Mitch Perry.